said at the State of the Union, saying oil prices were lower than under President Biden, and he was very proud of that. 30 seconds, your response.
He may put money into the hands of a few oil companies which pay his bills, which are corrupt, which pay his campaigns, but he's going to impoverish Americans, and he's throwing the entire world into a profound economic crisis. And the world's going to remember, and it's going to know very soon, Israel and the United States have put the entire world into a profound economic crisis. Again, the first thing you know, anything Trump writes is a combination of ignorance, malevolence, and lies, including that statement, Amy.
Jeffrey Sachs, we want to thank you so much for being with us. World-renowned economics professor, director of the Center for Sustainable Development at Columbia University, president of the UN Sustainable Development Solutions Network, has served as advisor to three UN secretaries general, now a sustainable development solutions advocate under Secretary General Antonio Guterres. We'll link to your articles at democracynow.org. As we end this show, a very fond farewell to our video fellow, Safwat Nazal. You will forever be in our DNA, Democracy Now! Alum. And thank you for your creativity, your humor, and your intelligence. Tonight, I'm heading to Mexico City for two screenings of Steal the Story, Please! At the Ambulante Film Festival. Tonight at Cineteca Nacional. Check out democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman-Gonzalez.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Development and Events Committee meets on the third Monday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Friday, March 20th at 6 p.m., KBOO makes everything metal. Somehow, the Metal March returns again in 2026, taking over even more of the airwaves. It's 12 whole hours of live bands and DJ sets from your favorite KBOO metal hosts. March 4th and support metal on KBOO. Tune in to the Metal March Marathon, Friday, March 20th at 6 p.m., through Saturday, March 21st at 6 a.m., only on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Hi, this is Cecil Prescott. Celeste Carey and I are the co-hosts for More Talk Radio, which airs on KBOO FM 90.7 on Mondays at 8 a.m. For 30 years, Celeste and I have been encouraging and engaging interviews and conversations about politics, social issues, and things which concerns you, your family, and your community. Join us on Mondays at 8 a.m. and be a part of this community radio experience.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland's big pipe overflows amid heavy rains.
Black business owners in Portland face a complex landscape of historical displacement and systemic barriers.
And Oregon's Farm Workers Union plans a general strike for Monday.
Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Friday, March 13th, 2026. I'm Sam Bowman.
And I'm Terrence Burns. Significant rainfall hit the Portland area the past few days, and early Thursday, the Big Pipe hit 100% capacity. That means some stormwater and sewage have overflowed into the Willamette River. Officials say people shouldn't swim south of Ross Island Bridge during the overflow and 2 days after. Overflow events like these used to happen some 50 times a year, but now it's usually less than five. The old overflow used to be really severe, billions of gallons of sewage and stormwater flooding into the Willamette and contaminating it. The Big Pipe Project was completed in 2011, and it's 12 to 22 feet in diameter. It was a game changer for wastewater and sewage treatment in the city and for the health of Portland's river. As of this afternoon, the Big Pipe capacity is only at 16%, prepared for another week of wet weather.
On Thursday, the Portland City Council Labor and Workforce Development Committee hosted a conversation about the state of black businesses in Portland. Monique Cardwell from the Greater Portland Incorporated spoke to the city councilors about the challenges that black businesses face in the city. Here's an excerpt of what she said.
The state of black businesses in the Portland region, really black businesses in Portland navigate very complex landscape of historical displacement as well as systemic barriers. Those barriers include systemic deinvestment and historic displacement, gentrification and rising costs, limited access to capital and loans, economic vulnerability and pandemic impact that we're still experiencing, vandalism and public safety concerns, and performative support and marketing challenges. In Oregon right now, black population makes up 4% of the population, and we make up just 1% of businesses in the state. And so there is untapped potential in the amount of black businesses we could have here. And what I see is we're operating on the margins of the Oregon economy and not truly embedded in the economy. So right now, again, there's no statewide data on black-owned business performance. We know last year, two legislative sessions, when Lance was over the organization, he lobbied hard for the Secretary of State that when you are filling out your paperwork, you're also self-identifying you're black-owned, right? Or where the business is coming from, and that received a lot of opposition. And so there are other ways in how we can identify, and I think that's important, because then we're able, once we have that type of data, we're able to troubleshoot a number of those challenges as well as offer more opportunities there.
That was Monique Cardwell from Greater Portland Incorporated speaking about some of the issues that black businesses face in Portland and in Oregon. She also highlighted a possible solution, the Black Business Association of Oregon, or BBAO. Nate McCoy is the interim president of the BBAO. He says the association was created to put commitments to racial justice into action.
The big takeaway for at least the creation of why BBAO exists is we all had to watch George Floyd lose his life in 2020 in front of everybody's camera and TV, and people forget about the root cause behind that. The root cause was he had a fake $20 bill, which was an economic disparity amongst not just what we see in Portland, but across the nation in many impoverished cities. And so the takeaway from that was, okay, we have a lot of people who will, you know, come out with slogans, Black Lives Matter, all the things that we see, but not a lot of action behind those words. And so we asked the Portland Metro Chambers, you know, let's not just have statements, let's actually create something that we can all work together on in partnership. And so that grew a division of NAMAC, BBAO, and raised $1 million in less than a year. And that wasn't white guilt money, that was allies who had influence who said, we will give you money and support your communities, and how can we help to support them as we continue?
That was Nate McCoy from the Black Business Association of Oregon. Council President Jamie Dunphy highlighted how city rules and regular operations disadvantage black businesses.
Gentlemen, thank you. This is a fantastic final presentation for this, so we can go off and bring this with us to all the other conversations we'll be having. thank you for advocating to not have more studies. This city, I firmly believe that government in this region believes that the act of studying something is itself an end. A study is supposed to be a means to an end. But we create all these, I've been saying it over and over again, we create beautiful PDFs that live on somebody's desktop and nobody ever looks again, and we never do the work. It is time to do the work and stop reinventing the wheel. There are a bunch of ways that this city currently disadvantages Black-owned businesses, specifically through the basic structure of our government, that I think we need to fix. First of all, the fact that we have a complaint-driven system means that we are empowering the worst voices in our community. And one of the first actions that this council took was actually repealing a section of the noise code that empowered neighbors to determine that something was too loud without measuring something, and cops could show up and shut it down. It's why Soleil's Jazz Club closed. It's what happened to a number of the historic Black-owned music venues in this city. And if you have a understaffed city apparatus and you are entirely operating off of complaint-driven systems, then you are empowering the worst voices in our community who know how to manipulate the system. And we are seeing time and time again where that is falling on the backs of Black entrepreneurs. And so we have a lot of work to do there. And the last thing I will say is that the legacy of economic development in this city through the PDC is, I believe, moving away from the horrible historical injustices, but they are not that historic. Nate, you said 60s, 70s, and 80s, but I still believe that the North Williams TIF district did a huge amount of disservice to the Black community. I still believe that the Lentz TIF district and the Gateway TIF district did an enormous amount of damage to displacing these Black communities. And I worry that the Cully TIF district may fall in the same position. We have seen that when we fund economic development dollars with our general fund, the last dollars in that they consider, probably arguably treat as the lowest priority, is the Inclusive Business Resource Network. Because anytime the city says, we have to tighten our budgets and cut back on the general fund, there's a doom and gloom narrative that is told to all the small business owners of color who are not thriving, but just barely surviving with these dollars. And the threat of taking away the few dollars that are actually helping businesses survive is enough to create existential fear, but is a deeply unfair narrative to not only those businesses, but to the general public. I think there's so much more we can do. I have a lot of faith in our new executive director at Prosper, but I think that the city still has a lot to tighten up our ship and understand where these historic structural problems really are, and we can do better. So thank you guys for continuing to demand more of us.
That was Portland City Council President Jamie Dunphy speaking at the City Council Labor and Workforce Development Committee's discussion on the state of Black business in Portland at their meeting on Thursday. In just a few weeks, the City Council will adopt a new structure of committees, condensing the roster of 8 down to just 5.
Oregon's Farmworkers Union is calling for a series of general strikes leading up to May Day, with the next strike scheduled for Monday, March 16th. Pineros y Campesinos Unidos del Noroeste, or PICUN, are calling for Oregonians not to go to work on the day without an immigrant. PICUN writes, the strikes will, quote, center and empower immigrant workers in a time when many fear leaving their homes. We ask for your solidarity in joining us in standing with farm workers and immigrant workers across the state, end quote. They encourage, quote, no work, no school, no spending. PICUN and the Salem Region Indivisible plan to hold a vigil and procession for the dead and disappeared by ICE at the Capitol Mall Plaza in Salem on Monday from 6 to 8 p.m.
The Oregon legislature has passed legislation requiring cardiac emergency response plans in all of the state's K-12 schools. Advocates call it a major step forward in protecting students, educators, and visitors during cardiac emergencies. KBOO's Eden Selman has more on the story.
Oregon schools will soon be required to have cardiac emergency response plans under legislation approved by the Oregon legislature and signed into law by Governor Tina Kotek. House Bill 4160 sets statewide standards to ensure K-12 schools are prepared to respond to cardiac emergencies. Dr. James Bashir with the Oregon Pediatric Society says the plans will ensure that schools and other gathering places are prepared to deal with a medical crisis.
Sudden cardiac arrest can occur at any time to anybody. And many kids who are at risk for sudden cardiac arrest have no idea that they're at risk until they have a sudden cardiac arrest episode.
The law requires schools to maintain response plans, have automated external defibrillators, conduct practice drills, coordinate with local emergency medical services, and provide CPR and AED training for key staff. Supporters say the measure could more than double survival rates from cardiac arrest by improving rapid recognition and response. Bashir says a cardiac emergency response plan ensures that trained school personnel are prepared to administer life-saving care until emergency responders arrive.
This should be part of the infrastructure of the building, just like when you're planning bathrooms and entrances and exits and all of those sorts of features. This should be part of public buildings like sports facilities and schools.
The bill was supported by the Oregon Smart Hearts Coalition and led by the American Heart Association. The measure requires that all school districts have a plan in place by the start of 2027 to the 2028 school year. Bashir says the new law is both cost-effective and a major step forward in protecting students, educators, and visitors during cardiac emergencies.
The cost of an AED is only about $2,000 to $3,000, depending on the unit, and this protects people for years and years, and it has fairly low maintenance costs.
For KBOO News and Oregon News Service, I'm Eden Selman.
President Trump declares victory over Iran. Congress questions military leaders on the future of the war, and TSA workers say they're at a real breaking point over the Homeland Security shutdown. With that story and more, it's Edwin J. Vieira with the 2026 Talks.
Welcome to 2026 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
You know, you never like to say too early you won. We won the bet. In the first hour, it was over.
Despite ongoing fighting in Iran, President Donald Trump is declaring victory in what he calls the bet that his administration has made in Operation Epic Fury. He's not saying when the conflict will stop. A U.S. aerial refueling tanker has crashed in Iraq. The fate of the crew is unknown. Iran's new supreme leader is vowing to keep the Strait of Hormuz closed. According to the New York Times, at least 16 tankers and cargo ships have been attacked there. Oil is still close to $100 a barrel, despite promised releases from emergency reserves. Polls show the Iran war is deeply unpopular and the stock markets are down sharply. The Pentagon estimates the first 6 days cost more than $11 billion, with every day after costing possibly another billion. Congressional Democrats point out this spending comes at the same time as deep cuts in healthcare and nutrition. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren said the administration apparently planned the war well ahead of time, but put no effort into safeguarding Americans caught in the region when it started.
The Trump administration chose this war. They planned this war for months, and they made no plans to safeguard hundreds of thousands of Americans in the region. There is no excuse for this.
Analysts from the Atlantic Council say the air war will severely weaken Iran's military capabilities, but isn't likely to cause the government to collapse. Gulf nations hit in Iranian counterattacks got the UN Security Council to vote for condemning those attacks. But American Ambassador Mike Waltz says Iran's actions prior to the war justify the conflict and show why the country shouldn't be allowed to have a nuclear weapon.
Iran has supported terrorist violence against civilians around the world, and as we all just saw in recent months, massacred its own people.
Police are treating an attack on a Michigan synagogue as a, quote, targeted act of violence. A man was killed after ramming his truck into the building. A security guard was the only other person injured. Meanwhile, Senate Democrats have again stopped a budget for the Homeland Security Department, demanding reforms after two protesters were shot dead by federal agents earlier this year. Republicans in the House are blocking an alternative Democratic plan that would fund DHS, except for ICE and the Border Patrol. Employees at FEMA, the TSA, and the Coast Guard have worked without their paychecks. Indiana TSA agents say the shutdown is taking a toll at Indianapolis International Airport. Kevin Smith with the American Federation of Government Employees Local says agents are still recovering from the last shutdown.
A lot of my officers are trying to pay back the loans they took out to survive the first time. So we got two or three paychecks and then boom, here we are again.
Federal law requires TSA agents to receive back pay once the shutdown ends, but Smith says around half a dozen TSA officers at Indianapolis International quit since the shutdown began. Airlines are expected to see a record 171 million passengers during March and April, and they're already seeing longer security lines. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines from Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali. Then at 7, it's Once Upon a Time. Tonight's weather will be rainy with an overnight low of 51 degrees. And tomorrow that rain continues with a daytime high of 51 degrees. Today in history, in 1781, the planet Uranus was discovered by astronomer William Herschel, who named the planet after the father of the god Saturn. In one of his other contributions to astronomy, Herschel also correctly hypothesized that nebulae are composed of stars. The quote of the day is from Ptolemy, the ancient astronomer from Alexandria, who said, quote, "Mortal as I am, I know that I am born for a day, but when I follow the serried multitude of the stars in their circular course, my feet no longer touch the earth."
This month marked the 6th annual bison donation by the city of Denver, sent to native tribes across the Mountain West to help with conservation efforts. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. This month, 34 bison were loaded into trailers at a park in Colorado's foothills and sent across the Mountain West region to tribal lands. The bison are part of herds that the city and county of Denver has managed for almost a century. And since 2020, 170 animals have been gifted to tribes. Jason Baldus is a member of the Eastern Shoshone Tribe in Wyoming and works with the Intertribal Buffalo Council. He says Denver's donations play a big role in bison restoration.
Because there are so few animals in isolated populations, it's important to diversify your gene pool so that you have a healthy population.
In this year's transfer, Navajo Nation received 11 bison and the Northern Cheyenne in Montana got 10. Leaders in the 1,000-mile sled dog race from Anchorage to Nome have reached the halfway point. Two of the mushers, Ryan Reddington, Anupia, and Pete Kaiser Yupik, are former champs of the Iditarod. Both have teams with some of the fastest speeds on the trail. Reddington was in third place early Friday morning, and Kaiser was not far behind in the 11th spot. There are three other indigenous mushers in the Iditarod, Kevin Hansen and Jesse Terry, who are in the middle of the pack. Both are rookies to the race, as well as Jody Potts Joseph, who, as Rhonda McBride reports, has been holding her own at the back of the pack.
Jody Potts Joseph is perhaps the most well-known rookie in the race. Her daughter, Quanna Chasing Horse, is a high-fashion model, and both are outspoken environmental advocates. And now, Potts Joseph is making a name for herself along the trail. On her way to McGrath, her team ran into the unexpected.
On this trail going up into the hills, I just came around a corner and there's a bison standing in the middle of the trail.
Other mushers had encountered the bison. Because of a heavy snowpack this year, the animals have been using the hardened Iditarod trail. In an interview with the Iditarod Insider, Potts Joseph described how her dogs went wild when they saw the bison, which appeared ready to charge. She pulled out her gun to shoot some shots to scare it, but the gun misfired. It just clicked.
So I was just grabbing sticks and throwing it at it and hollering and didn't do anything. It was just standing there and it still was just pawing and looking pissed off.
At a loss for what to do next, she remembered a story from her grandmother who fended off a bear outside her cabin by hollering at it in her native Han Gwich'in language. And the bear turned around and walked away. The musher thought it was worth a try against the bison.
That was my last resort, so I just said, "Antla chin chad, chichu nehuchina," and that bison, popped its head up and then just turned around and trotted on down the trail. I almost can't believe it myself.
In her language, she repeated the exact words her grandmother used against the bear. "Go away, have mercy on us, leave us alone." She said her grandmother was right. Animals do understand Gwich'in. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
The Cherokee Nation in Oklahoma recently added an amendment to the tribe's Public Health and Wellness Fund Act to set aside funds for the tribe's reentry program. $6.5 million is being set aside in new opioid settlement funds, which will include building and operating transitional housing for formerly incarcerated Cherokee citizens. According to the Cherokee Nation, in 2017, it became the first tribe in the country to sue the opioid industry for damages. The tribe has continued its legal efforts, which include the latest settlement. The reentry program served 500 Cherokee citizens last year. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Public health advocates are voicing concerns that this Oscar season, tobacco imagery appears in 8 of the 10 films nominated for Best Picture. Experts say this can normalize smoking and vaping for young viewers in particular, and warn that such depictions can also trigger relapse among those trying to quit. They're urging the entertainment industry to add prevention ads and quitting resources around tobacco-related content. Judith Ruiz Branch has the details.
Ahead of this weekend's Oscars show, public health advocates in Illinois and across the country are voicing concerns about the prevalence of tobacco imagery in the season's top films and the subsequent impact on youth. This year, 8 out of 10 movies nominated for Best Picture contained scenes with vaping or smoking, according to a report by the Truth Initiative Schroeder Institute. Senior Vice President at the Institute, Dr. Jessica Rath, notes that's a 10% increase compared to last year's films. She says this is particularly concerning for young people who are twice as likely to start smoking or vaping when exposed to it in movies.
This continued depiction of cigarettes and other products in popular award-nominated films really normalizes this addictive behavior for impressionable viewers, and that extends well beyond award season.
Rath says her organization is advocating for the entertainment industry to intervene by showing prevention ads and resources for quitting before or after content containing tobacco use. In Illinois, people can access free support by texting vape-free IL to 88709. Rath says tobacco imagery in movies can also make it harder for those already addicted to nicotine to quit successfully. Research shows more than 40% of young people with intentions to quit reported that seeing tobacco in shows, content, or movies made them more likely to relapse.
So when we have imagery glamorized on screens, it really undermines efforts that have been made in tobacco control.
In 2024, about 262 million people were exposed to tobacco in movies. Rath says as streaming platforms continue to dominate how youth watch films, concerns over ease of exposure for this age group is growing. For Illinois News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch.
Experts say it's important for gardeners to know how to help their gardens withstand climate change. Healthy soils and diverse perennial plants can help your garden beds survive extreme weather like floods and droughts. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. The days are getting longer, and spring is around the corner. For many home gardeners, it's a time of hope and anticipation. So it's the perfect time to plan how to help your flower beds thrive as climate change brings more extreme and unpredictable weather.
Flooding, droughts, heat, cold, all the extreme weather we're seeing is going to impact plants.
That's Christy Marsden of the University of Minnesota Climate Adaptation Partnership. She says one of the most important things you can do is get your soil tested, and then take steps to improve your soil health, for example, by adding compost. Healthier soil retains more water during droughts, and it's less likely to erode during heavy storms. Marsden also suggests growing a wider mix of flowers than you might have grown before, with varieties that thrive in a range of conditions. And she recommends relying more on perennial plants, which come back every year, and less on annuals.
Perennials are more able to withstand some of those extremes because they have deeper roots, they're more established.
So while climate change is a challenge, she says by being flexible and trying new things, you can still grow a beautiful garden in a warming world. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Drive the snakes from your brain. It's time for The Point Puzzle, the weekly radio brain teaser produced by Pearl Stark at KPOV Bend. This week's puzzle concerns an upcoming holiday.
It's time for the puzzle.
Last week, I asked you to start with the capital of a country in three syllables. Change the internal consonant sounds, and you have the capital city of a bordering country. Well, the answer is Budapest and Bucharest. And our winners this week are Barry and Wendy Hurwitz, who stream KPOV from Newton, Massachusetts. For the new puzzle, start with an item in two syllables, often used to represent an upcoming holiday. Change an S to a C, drop the last three letters, and rearrange what's left to get what that item might represent. You can rearrange the letters again to get when the holiday occurs. So again, start with an item from an upcoming holiday, change an S to a C, drop the last three letters, and rearrange what's left to get what that item might represent. You can rearrange the letters again to get when the holiday occurs. When you have an answer, send your name, your answer, and the station in which you hear the puzzle to puzzle@kpov.org. I'll select one winner from among any answers received by this Saturday.
It's times like these to learn.
This has been Pearl Stark with your Point Puzzle for the week of March 9th. The Point Puzzle is produced at KPOV, High Desert Community Radio.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, March 13th, 2026. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1000.